From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, this is Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. A good old-fashioned coming-of-age story features change and personal growth. Today, skateboarders riding for a better life.
For many of the skaters, that's what it was all about, was actively choosing a life that isn't about violence, that isn't about extorting others, that isn't about harming others, but trying to find some kind of peaceful activity to band together and create a community.
And a school helping kids adjust to their new home through diversity.
I know that every single person comes from a different country too, so they went through the same thing that I did. That's something we have in common, so I feel kind of comfortable.
Plus, seniors who are choosing fun over loneliness, and so much more, as we bring you stories of people coming of age in their lives, identities, and careers. That's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. Check this out. Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bissinger was addicted to buying leather pants. Also, there's a rare brain condition where you believe that you're already dead and you do not exist. I mean, goodness. Now, this is the type of crazy stuff you will learn if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear genuinely surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones to follow. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. And today we're talking about coming of age stories. And if you don't know what I mean, you've definitely seen some of the movies that are coming of age stories. Think of things like Real Women Have Curves or Y Tu Mama Tambien or Hollywood classics like Rebel Without a Cause. You know, they're movies where the protagonist goes from being young to an adult or just maturing in some way. Some kind of moral growth happens. And in a lot of ways, migrating can be sort of a coming of age. You're entering this new phase in your life. There's a lot of change to adjust to. And if you know us here at Latino USA, you know that we do cover immigration quite often. And we're always looking for different and new immigration stories, which is why an article in Rolling Stone recently caught the eye of our producer, Antonia Cerejido.
Yeah, it's a story about migrating like I've never heard before. And so I reached out to the writer of the article, Levi Vonk. He's this American guy. He's living in Mexico because he's a Fulbright scholar. And he describes this day in April when he was walking in a rural town in southern Mexico.
And I'm just walking and walking. I'm really tired.
He's in Juchitán, Oaxaca, participating in this migrant rights march.
The sun is beating down and all of a sudden I just hear shoo. And I was like, what was that? And I looked again and there's shoo, another one. And I was thinking, oh gosh, what is that? And then I see these four skater guys just zip by, which was the weirdest, most surreal thing I've ever seen.
Levi talked to them and found out they were migrants.
Skateboarding migrants?
Yeah, I never heard of a group of migrants traveling on skateboards before.
¿Y de dónde eres?
El Salvador.
They are these four skater dudes from El Salvador, traveling without papers, and they have one goal in mind. Here's one of the guys, Kelvin.
California es la mejor opción para nosotros, pues.
They wanted to go to LA because it's the land of skaters and glitz, and, you know, they heard it had jobs and they heard it had good skating.
By the time they met Levi, the crew had already skated across Guatemala, except for when the trail wouldn't allow it and they'd have to go by foot. Kelvin is the oldest. He's 27 and the de facto captain of the crew.
He was wearing a UNC basketball shirt and he was wearing these bright lime green Vans.
The rest of the guys are 20 years old, including Kelvin's best friend and sidekick, Renee.
He was wearing this big, he's a very skinny guy, but he was wearing this big Beavis and Butthead Christmas t-shirt that was kind of like flapping, almost like wings behind him as he ripped down the highway.
Then there's Kevin, not Kelvin, Kevin.
Se llama Kevin.
Kevin.
Kevin was the shyest of the group.
And the last member is Eliseo, who was the least shy, pretty talkative, and very strong-willed.
José Eliseo Durán López.
They all met kind of in the small skating community in San Salvador.
Small, but committed. Here's Kelvin, the de facto captain, describing what it takes to learn a trick.
Que si no estaba en la cancha practicando con mi amigo, yo llegaba a la casa, agarraba mi patineta y me ponía a intentar un truco y agarraba el truco.
Even if you don't speak Spanish, you can still hear the passion in this man's voice. And that's because skateboarding is more than just a way to get around.
Pues es una forma de desahogarnos.
Kelvin says skateboarding was an escape. It was a way for all of the guys, not just him, to forget about their problems, even if for only a moment. But skating in El Salvador is risky.
Skating is not something that's encouraged. Not necessarily by, you know, it's not discouraged by their parents or an older generation like we might think about in the United States. It's discouraged by the gangs who run the areas. And it's discouraged because they see it as a threat to their power within the neighborhoods.
That's because skating is an alternative to gang life. And gangs don't want any alternatives.
For many of the skaters, that's what it was all about, was actively choosing a life that isn't about violence, that isn't about extorting others, that isn't about harming others, but trying to find some kind of peaceful activity to band together and create a community.
Para acá, había muchos reclutamientos.
Rene says that starting last February, the gang stepped up their recruitment efforts. And in March,
a few kids were skating in the park, and the gang members showed up and beat them really badly.
A handful of the fellow skaters ended up in the hospital. And for our four skater dudes, that was it.
So they got together a little money they had, grabbed a change of clothes, really just one change of clothes each, and split.
As they traveled, they began to meet skaters along the way in Guatemala and Mexico.
Entonces, y siempre donde vayamos y tengamos nuestra tabla y encontremos compañeros que patinen, nos ayuda y nos protege, pues.
Kelvin says that local skaters are able to give them a heads up about any of the dangers they might find in that area.
Es un poco de divertido porque vas conociendo gente, te vas haciendo amigos.
And also, Rene says, it was just fun. They made friends. Some of the local skaters would even invite the crew to party with them.
Armonía, paz, amor con nuestros hermanos mexicanos.
He says,
esa es la verdad.
The only thing we're looking for is brotherhood and harmony and peace with all our Mexican brothers.
It's almost like an informal transnational skater kid network. But there was another unexpected benefit of skating the migrant trail.
Nosotros es nuestra pantalla, pues, ¿me entendés?
Kelvin calls the skateboard a screen.
Así nosotros nos disfrazamos de que nos agarre la migración.
A disguise, so that the Mexican immigration agents won't catch them.
Up until very recently, the journey has been, it can actually be fairly quick for Central American migrants or even Mexican migrants because they could take a train passage called La Bestia.
But the Mexican government has been cracking down on Central Americans riding the train. They're trying to deport migrants before they even get to the U.S., which means they're on the lookout for people they think might be Central American.
La gente nos confunde, a veces nos dice nos confunde con estudiantes del área.
Kelvin says that people mistake them for students or think that they're cool alternative kids coming from Mexico City, and this protects them.
Me ha llamado mucho la atención que ahora ya no quiero ni despegármela porque solo con ella duermo aquí, me la echo en la cabecita acá atrás cuando duermo y no me la despego.
Rene is surprised how much he's come to love his board, considering that he was one of the weaker skaters when they started the trip. Now he says he never wants it to leave his side. He even sleeps with it and uses it as a pillow. A couple weeks after first meeting them, Levi caught up with the guys in Mexico City. By that point, the guys had been skating for months together.
Little did I know, the very next day, that's when Kevin and Eliseo would split.
Tension had bubbled up in the group. Kelvin and Eliseo had been butting heads over what route to take.
Kelvin was adamant that they would not ride La Bestia. It's very dangerous. There are gangs that come up and you know, attack people and rape them or extort them.
But Eliseo was exhausted. Kevin was too.
And so these two guys caught the train, headed up, and headed right into an immigration checkpoint.
Wait, so were they deported?
Yeah. Kevin and Eliseo were deported, but now they're both trying to make their way back up to the U.S. border.
So what about Kelvin and Renee?
Kelvin actually made it to the U.S. and is somewhere in Texas right now, but Renee is currently being detained at the Rio Grande Detention Center.
So the plan to skate their way up north and become California skate kids didn't work?
Well, no. But they haven't given up yet, and these guys are incredibly resourceful.
El skate te abre muchas puertas. Te abre también tu mente para hacer trucos nuevos, ¿verdad? Y todo.
Kelvin says that skating opens lots of doors, and even doors in your mind. And I know that's kind of cheesy, but skating did allow them to escape gang life.
Yeah, and honestly, skaters are known for turning the world into their own personal playgrounds, you know? Think of the kids in Southern Cali skating in empty pools because they didn't have actual ramps and such.
And there's something about what Kelvin said about how he would do a trick over and over again. I mean, it's a mindset. The skater mindset is like zen, and you'll just do it again and again, and I think that these guys aren't going to give up.
Those skateboarders are young dudes. They're not really tied down by anything. But that freedom to pick up and go is not exclusive to young people. It can also be true when you get much older. Though at that age, it might feel more like loneliness than liberation. Unless you can go somewhere where you can meet people at a similar place in their lives and who also share your language and your culture. Reporter Martha Dalton takes us to one such place in Atlanta.
This is a Zumba class. It may not be moving at the same pace as a CrossFit class for 20-year-olds, but it is moving. Hips are shaking, feet are shuffling, and people are singing.
They do exercise, they do yoga, they do aerobics. They have music and poems and singing amongst them.
Jeffrey Tapia is the president of Atlanta's Latin American Association. Her group organizes the Club de la Tercera Edad, the third age club for Latino seniors. They meet every Friday.
They celebrate their holidays and their birthdays. They get bring in educational speakers. And it's a little bit of that piece that's missing for them. They become family together.
Family. That's how 93-year-old Gloria Patiño puts it.
Me gusta mucho el grupo. Me gusta especialmente la colaboración de todos.
I really like the group, she says. I especially like the collaboration between everyone. They're like my brothers and sisters.
El amor, la comprensión.
The love, the understanding. That's why Carmen Oquendo makes the 30-mile drive every week. Carmen's originally from Colombia. She has 5 children and 10 grandchildren. Except for 1 grandchild, they all live far away, grown up and living their own lives.
Yo vivo sola. Tengo muchos hijos y muchos nietos, pero nadie va a la casa, entonces un día por lo menos estoy reunida con gente.
I live alone, she says. I have a lot of kids and grandkids, but no one comes to the house. So one day, more or less, I belong to a group. And that group stays busy. Here's Armando Monaco singing El Día Que Me Quieras, an old classic everyone seems to know.
El suave murmullo de tu suspirar.
Gloria, the 93-year-old, is not to be outdone. She recites a poem she wrote for Thanksgiving from memory.
Gracias, Señor, por el pan que das al diario vivir y por el precioso don de la gratitud sentir.
Thank you, Lord, for our daily bread and for the precious gift of gratitude, she says.
Pues yo ahora acá les tengo las recetas.
The club's leader, Griselda Bustamante, is handing out a booklet of favorite recipes the seniors have shared. She says they keep her on her toes. It's a cast of characters, lots of different personalities, she says. Sometimes I have to lower the temperature. Unless, of course, it's time for Zumba. For Latino USA, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
I've never tried Zumba myself. I'm more into working out alone, but maybe I'll have to rethink that as I get older. After the break, we hear from the directors of a new documentary about Puerto Rico's trans community.
There's this big gap of information here. There's all these ideas that you have of this community, and they're, you know, we're finding that they're mostly incorrect.
Next on Latino USA. Stay with us. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to take a second to ask you to rate and review our show on iTunes. It's really helpful because it makes it more likely other people will find our show, so thank you. Also, I love it when I get to guest host for Maria, but even when I don't, I am a full-time producer on Latino USA, and that means I'm a part of the team that works very hard every week to bring you the content that you love. I have to say, some of the kind words, the emails, the tweets that you send, they mean a lot. If you are unaware, the company that makes our show is a nonprofit, and if you can afford it, please consider donating. Every single penny helps. You can do that by going to latinousa.org and clicking on the donate button. All right, let's get back to it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to make education more affordable for students and flexible for teachers through open educational resources. Online at hewlett.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa.
Yo soy reina, pero me identifico más como una diva. Muchos me dicen que me ven bella o me consideran bella. Otras personas no me consideran bella, pero whatever. I know I'm fabulous.
That's Queen B. Ho, a drag queen from Puerto Rico. She's saying that while she's a queen, she actually considers herself more of a diva, and that people tell her she's beautiful while others don't, but to her it's whatever. Hopefully you heard her say that she knows she's fabulous. Now, if you are a faithful Latino USA listener, you may remember that I once did a story explaining that all my favorite queens on the reality competition show RuPaul's Drag Race came from the tiny island. In the segment, I spoke with a queen from the series named April Carrion. Now, Carrion, along with Queen Bee Ho, are two of the people profiled in a new documentary all about the trans community in Puerto Rico. The film is called Mala Mala. That means bad, bad. It was a hit at the 2014 Tribeca Film Festival, but only got distribution recently. Transgender issues have been in the news lately, but there's still a lot that Americans don't know about the trans experience, especially as it exists outside of mainland United States. So for today's show on Coming of Age, I decided to speak to Mala Mala directors Antonio Santini and Dan Sickles about the film and why they made it. Turns out they had their own questions about the unique challenges faced by people who don't conform to society's ideas of gender. Here's Dan.
Why don't we know anything about this? Like, why are we not talking about gender more? Like, when did we decide that we were guys? You know, like, we've been prescribed all of these, you know, identities, but, like, we don't really, really think about them. And, like, why is that, you know? We chose Puerto Rico because it's, you know, in a really, really interesting geopolitical situation. I mean, it's really, really figuring out how to articulate its voice in the modern world, I think. You know, right now, it's very much in crisis.
Dan's producing and directing partner, Antonio, grew up on the island, but eventually moved to New York. And he realized that many Americans don't know much about Puerto Rico at all.
There's this big gap of information here. There's all these ideas that you have of this community, and they're, you know, we're finding that they're mostly incorrect. Even though it was on one island, it always felt like we were going to a completely different country just to go film. People were always worried for us. People were always afraid that we were going to get robbed or hurt.
Plus, making the film in Puerto Rico would let Antonio address questions that he'd asked himself many times.
Growing up, honestly, and thinking, wow, Paris has this incredible French cinema culture. America has this incredible cinema culture. Spain has this incredible cinema culture. Why can't we access Puerto Rican films all the time? What is going on? Why are we always consuming Spider-Man on the island? Why are we always watching Batman?
Not much comes from Puerto Rico, especially to the mainland in terms of media. So we thought that it would be important for people to see, you know, this kind of microcosm of a microcosm.
Like Puerto Rico itself, the movie features a mix of people speaking English and Spanish, which confused some people.
We would get comments back from our agent at that time who would say things like, the market has spoken. There's really not that big of a market for a foreign language doc. And we'd say, this isn't a foreign language doc. This is a film about the trans experience. Why do you have to change the name of what it is? That was the big challenge, you know, people telling us literally, oh, why would anyone want to watch a film about Puerto Rican transgender culture? And we'd say, well, you're not the right person to handle it then.
Then, of course, there were also the practical challenges of making a documentary, like finding people who were willing to share their experiences on camera.
One thing that we tried to do was access the sex work community. A lot of the trans sex workers hung around the clubs where the drag queens performed, but it was really difficult for us to communicate with them because if you're not a client at that hour when they're outside, they don't really want to talk to you.
And, you know, Antonio and I, we were 22 years old and we really didn't know how to go about it. And we had made flyers, you know, with some photos from the film on it and like our names and our phone numbers. And we would walk up to them on the street and be like, hey, like, so we're making a movie and we would love to talk to you about, you know, your experience. And we would hand them this flyer and they would just like look at us like we had three heads, you know, like they were like, who are these like baby looking boys like coming up to us at, like 2 o'clock in the morning, like telling us that they want to make a movie and giving us like their personal contact information. And then we started going to outreach organizations at one point along the way and, you know, talking with them and being like, who should we be talking to for this type of project? And they sent us to Ivana Fred.
Ivana is a trans advocate on the island.
Ivana is literally the Laverne Cox of Puerto Rico. You know, she is a huge activist.
She's been all over the Puerto Rican media. This is a clip they use in Mala Mala.
Buenas noches, Rubén. La prensa ya pues como me ve como un recurso. Y siempre que tienen el tema de algo de la comunidad trans, hoy día pues ahí estoy.
And the reason she knows everyone is because she does outreach. So she drives around every weekend handing out safe sex materials to the sex workers and telling them, please use them, and also inviting them to different conferences. So she basically was like a big address book of every person on the island who identified as trans. It was pretty amazing. She just knew all of them in their head. You know, the community is big, but it's also relatively small because it's a small island.
She's a major figure in the trans community now, but Antonio says it took Ivana a long time to come to terms with her identity.
No matter what she does, no matter how feminine she appears, no matter how much work she puts into her appearance, people in the end will always perceive her as a transsexual. And that's something that she personally has decided to identify as.
Yo siento que decir que soy una transexual para mí es más un orgullo que una vergüenza, independientemente la carga que esto traiga a nivel de la sociedad.
So that's really led her to this whole process of starting to see herself that way and kind of like a self-acceptance. And because of that, she's taking it on to make other girls feel empowered by their identity and not feel ashamed of being transsexual, because she realized that the process of becoming the woman that she is now really defined her.
The subjects of the film aren't the only ones who had to face change and acceptance. Here's Dan.
I lost both of my parents when we were finishing up the film, within 4 months of each other. And then you come into, like, contact with, like, your own mortality via, like, your parents' demise, and it's like, I have all of this choice that I've always had, but now it's like there's this huge potentiality for me. All of us kind of had the realization that, like, we're adults now. Like, we're adults who are, like, in the business of creating, you know, something meaningful out of, like, the chaos of life, you know? And that is, like, a huge responsibility.
This sort of growing up together brought the cast and crew of Mala Mala closer together.
We built some sort of family, and what was born from, like, this family happened to, like, be this 87-minute-long film called Mala Mala. And Antonio one day was just like, yo, like, this is a trans fairy tale. And I was like, yes, this is a trans fairy tale. And I think more, you know, more than it being like a documentary about transgender culture in Puerto Rico, like it really is a film much more about the power of transformation, told through people who happen to identify similarly, but not the same.
There isn't only one type of trans experience. Mala Mala reflects this by including many characters, including Sandy, an activist and sex worker.
Esto es de la manera que el gobierno me ha hecho vivir, las necesidades de mi vida me ha hecho vivir. Y no le encuentro nada malo porque es una parte de mi cuerpo que a mí no me gusta.
And Pax, who's struggling to find a hormone treatment that will reflect his gender identity.
I don't think I fit a binary way of life. So I'm neither nor, you know. I guess I'm happy with that. I mean, no es por fiebre, o sea, yo no pedí ser de esta manera, loco.
Dan hopes the film will bring some important voices to the mainstream, but urges all of us, you and me, to go beyond that.
Trans being in the spotlight right now and people talking about trans issues is a positive thing. You know, that also for me comes with some worry. you know, that this narrative won't be as inclusive and diverse as it could potentially be. I think it's important that, like, we continuously, like, work to notice who is in control of very brand new narratives that represent marginalized communities. And I guess that's the only thing, like, literally holding me back from, like, screaming at the top of my lungs about how happy I am, you know, that Caitlyn Jenner is on the cover of Vanity Fair. For me, I think we lend a lot of power right away, especially in the United States, to celebrities. We need to keep reminding ourselves that it is about the little people. You know, it's not always about somebody with a TV show or with a gold medal. It is about the demographic that we're talking about, which, you know, has a high rate of suicide, like, has a high rate of drug use. Like, there are staggering statistics as to, like, how this community has been neglected for decades, and we need to remind ourselves of that.
Dan Sickles and Antonio Centini are the directors of the documentary film Mala Mala. Thanks to them for stopping by the Latino USA studio in Harlem. And you can go to our website for information about how to see the movie where you are. You know, one question the film raises, and I want to talk about this without any spoilers, is the question of support and having support from structural systems. You know, how might that make it easier to come of age, as it were? Here's an example of what I mean. Immigrant children arriving in the United States often speak little to no English, and then they're thrown into an education system that's completely new to them. Many of these kids end up slipping between the cracks in schools that can't give them the support they need. So what would support in those systems look like? One group of schools in New York City is asking that very question. Instead of seeing these kids as outsiders, it has a teaching model based on the very diversity these kids bring with them. Reporter Golda Arthur went to one of the schools to find out what that means.
I like my table. I like my group. Right here we have Sheda. Where are you from again? Uzbekistan. And we have Saba, and he's from Georgia. Kasim is 18, and he's from Egypt, right? Yemen. And we have Hansel Rojas. He's from Peru, and he's 20.
This is the 12th grade economics class at the International School in Brooklyn, where Diana Acevedo is a senior.
And I'm from the Dominican Republic.
There's no one from the same country at this table.
No, not at all, which is nice.
Teacher Matthew Hoffman and his students are talking personal finance, budgets, and pie charts.
Metro transportation costs just increased in New York City. How much is a Metro card now? $2.75. And what did it used to be? $2.50, right? And this is keep on increasing. What do you predict that will do to this percentage then? It'll increase, so maybe we'll go from 17 to 18 to 19%.
Diversity is not an exception to the rule here. It is the rule. Even in a city like New York, which is so multicultural, the international school stands apart. Out of 350 students here, there are 40 different cultures represented.
Yeah, there can easily be a classroom with, out of 20 students, 10 different languages spoken in the room.
John Harriman is the school's principal. On the wall outside his office, he points to a large poster.
So what do we see here? We see China, the biggest.
So currently, like, our largest population is Chinese. We have a lot of students from Uzbekistan, quite a few from Guatemala.
These students are some of the country's newest arrivals. The only requirement to get into the international high school is to be in the U.S. for 4 years or less. Many of these kids have no documentation. Some don't have close family here. Others come from a background of conflict. And on top of all of this, they don't speak much English when they first enroll.
We are very much not the English-only approach to school, so we really want students to, obviously, learning English is essential for college and for success, but it's also, we really want them to use their language. We want them to learn. We want them to think. We want them to critique. We want them to criticize and to write. So there's work done both in their first language as well as in English.
The International School was founded in 2005. It's part of a small network of schools, mostly based in New York, and designed specifically for recent immigrant students with little or no English. The model originated in New York City about 30 years ago in response to growing numbers of immigrant children who were struggling in traditional classrooms. Here, Diversity is a positive thing, and no one is treated differently for being new or foreign. All of this helped Diana when she first came here.
I didn't really have a great experience in middle school, so I didn't really get to learn a lot of English because I did not socialize. It wasn't like an international middle school. It was more like full of white people, white kids, so they really knew English. And I was kind of afraid of speaking, and I think that's why. I kind of isolated myself.
School is better for Diana now. She has plans for the future. She has books. Reading is her passion. And she has friends. There's very little pressure here to fit into a predetermined norm.
I know that every single person comes from a different country too, so it's kind of related to me. It's like a mirror reflection because I know they went through the same thing that I did, or maybe even worse, maybe even better, but that's something we have in common. So I feel kind of comfortable.
At the other end of the spectrum from Diana, who's been here for 4 years, is Pablo. He's been here for 1 week, and he doesn't speak much English.
Sí, me gusta esta escuela porque, primero porque...
Pablo is a shy young man of 17. The school asked that we only use his first name since he's undocumented. He came to New York on his own last year, an unaccompanied minor from Guatemala.
Bueno, pues cuando salimos de allá, pues desde México hasta llegar a la frontera de Estados Unidos, fue puro traslación de buses.
He spent 15 days on a bus from Guatemala to Mexico, he says, then 5 days on foot through the U.S. border. He traveled with a group of other unaccompanied young people he didn't know.
Oh, porque al llegar aquí, usted sabe que se paga un dinero. Entonces, ese dinero yo no tenía donde sacarlo. Tuve que trabajar.
Pablo says he spent his first year working in order to pay for the trip. But he always wanted to go to school. So when his debts were paid off, he enrolled himself here. He likes the fact that the school is free and tells me his favorite subject is social science, where he's learning about human rights. So what do you do when you have a kid at this level whose English is still not great and they have to get around that as well as 12th grade algebra? How do you cope with that? Wendy Lay teaches 12th grade algebra.
Oh, it's very challenging. We have dictionaries in all classrooms. Our lesson, we try to really not just teaching math here, we're all English teachers.
The kids get help not only from their teachers, but also from their fellow students.
In the present, and yesterday was past. We're going to be talking about the future. All right, what about change?
In Katie Dratz's visual arts class, kids who speak different languages are deliberately assigned to sit at the same table, which encourages them to communicate with each other in English.
Right. When they first come, we usually try to pair them up with somebody, or if their language levels are slightly low, we'll give them a buddy kind of to help them out. But eventually, as they get more comfortable, they venture out, they're asking their table mates for more help.
So all of these strategies seem to produce students who, despite coming from different backgrounds, are immensely focused on learning English and everything else on offer.
The king doth keep his revel here tonight. Take heed, the queen, come now within his sight.
Like Shakespeare, unfolding right in the middle of the hallway.
Because that she has her attendant hath a lovely boy stolen from an Indian king.
The formula seems to work. The international school's graduation rate is 61% for English language learners, about twice the graduation rate for ELL students in the rest of the state. These kids know that in many countries, education can be more of a privilege than a right. And they value this opportunity to live and learn here because each has, in their own way, paid a price for it. For Latino USA, I'm Golda Arthur in New York.
That all their elves for fear creep into a crown cups and hide them there.
You know, this reminds me, I remember years ago watching a Yankees game, and during some slow moment, the announcers were talking about two players, one Latino and the other, I think, Japanese, and how they'd become close friends. You'd always see them together because they were both learning English, and they understood each other's broken English better than they did everyone else. Man, I wish I could remember who that was exactly, but thanks to Golda Arthur for that story. And when we come back, my chat with the stars of the hit film Straight Outta Compton.
Not every song was positive.
Right.
Not every song was, you know, fight the powers that be. You know? But what they spoke was the truth.
Stay with us. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. Check this out. Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bissinger was addicted to buying leather pants. Also, there's a rare brain condition where you believe that you're already dead and you do not exist. I mean, goodness. Now, this is the type of crazy stuff you will learn if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear genuinely surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones to follow. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
No íbamos a pie, comiendo un completo el desayuno, un té. 7:30 caminando Gran Avenida para ver 5:30, hey. Rey Alberto, Arcángel, Metro, San Miguel, Vallejo, Central, Chico y MLP. Cuando nos encontramos, lo hablamos, vivimos. Recuerdo de niño, te canto aquí. Vida buena que no quiere olvidar. Desde dónde viene y hacia dónde va. Todo lo vivido lo guardo, lo escribo, lo uso de nuevo y lo canto aquí. Una antena atenta para recibir todos los mensajes que vienen de ahí. De cada rincón, cada cosa que pasa, una fuerza distinta que vio venir.
Te vi ayer caminando por San Miguel. Te vi Gran Avenida Salesiano.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Roth Family Foundation, investing in organizations that inspire hope, dignity, and creativity, working to connect communities to the services, opportunities, and tools for self-empowerment and self-expression. Learn more at rothfamilyfoundation.org. And the SCAN Foundation, working to advance a coordinated system of high-quality services for older adults that preserve dignity and independence. More information is available at thescanfoundation.org.
This is DeCassis Straight Outta Compton. This is Jason Mitchell. I play Eazy-E.
This is Corey Hawkins. I play Dr. Dre.
This is O'Shea Jackson Jr., and I play Ice Cube.
And I'm Daisy Rosario, guest hosting for Maria Hinojosa. Welcome back to Latino USA. Straight Outta Compton was last week's big box office hit. The movie is the coming-of-age story of the rap group N.W.A., and most specifically, its best-known members, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E. The success of the movie has surprised many, but for true hip-hop heads, it was maybe not a shock. The group really is legendary. They helped put California hip-hop on the map. If you've heard our own specials, A Latino History of Hip-Hop Parts 1 and 2, you know that mainstream rap music at the time N.W.A. debuted was extremely New York-centric.
They heard everybody saying we're Brooklyn at, you know, Queens in the house.
South Bronx.
South Bronx, you know, the Boogie Down, you know. And they were like, well, we're Compton at it, know. Compton's in the house.
And I don't know if anybody ever been to Compton or L.A., period. But the Latino community is deep.
Yes, it is.
They are definitely Compton. You know what I mean? So it ain't just black people in Raider hats and Jerry Curls hollering Compton.
As much of as much members of this movie, you know, especially the Latino community, a sixth member of N.W.A.
Yeah, the city is by far the sixth member.
You know,
representing people who represented a place added a lot of pressure.
I'm playing Andre Young, you know, not Dr. Dre. O'Shea is playing O'Shea. Jackson Sr., you know what I mean, not Ice Cube. It's really just about, you know, getting to know them, and they just became, they were just honest with us, you know?
Right.
They gave us everything we needed to just get it right because they wanted to get it right. It's a huge pressure.
Especially a lot of pressure when you're filming in Compton.
Right.
Right.
And they're there, like, and they're on the street.
They walking up like, hey, homie, you got that easy roll, huh, homie? And it's special that all of them coming together and kind of, like, spitball off of each other.
Right.
Because if they be like, nah, that ain't how I remember it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's times that, you know, that needs to happen because it's important for it to be about the story of N.W.A., you know what I mean? Like, it was kind of special to hear Ice Cube say, you know, like, that he learned a lot from the movie because while he, you know, over here doing his own thing in his solo career, he didn't know what was going on with N.W.A. He didn't know how he was feeling about certain things, you know? So it's like, it was good to see all of them come together and, you know, really try to get the best out of what they wanted. And that can't do nothing but push us at the end of the day. Yep. You know, how does that look? You get the N.W.A. story wrong? Oh, man, suicide action.
The film covers some sensitive issues, and to let you know, the rest of this conversation will as well. Some early attention talked quite a bit about how the movie addresses police brutality, which of course feels particularly timely. There are scenes showing why the group released a controversial song in 1988 complaining of their treatment by the police. O'Shea Jackson Jr. plays his real-life father Ice Cube in the movie. Cube co-wrote the song.
There's a reason why N.W.A. didn't write F the Firefighters. You know, like they're a real service. You know, they got to figure it out within them, within their own, you know, jurisdiction or whatever the hell, to really figure out what's going on and start being some heroes,
right?
Man.
And in the meantime, don't be a hero. You know what I'm saying?
For real. Exactly.
Like, you know, to all my black and brown people, don't be a hero, man. Make it home to your family.
More recent feedback on the movie has centered on why the film doesn't address misogyny, both in N.W.A.'s lyrics and in their actions. I didn't get into that with these guys because they are actors playing a role. Real people, yes, but actors. But O'Shea Jr. did have this to say.
The things that they were doing at a young age, you know, not every song was positive.
Right.
Not every song was, you know, fight the powers that be, you know. But what they spoke was the truth. It was, you know, just a reflection of their reality.
Overall, there are some very good, very interesting conversations being had because of the film. Ultimately, this is a movie and it doesn't reflect every part of reality. For example, we do not see a scene where Dr. Dre assaults Dee Barnes, a female music journalist, in 1991, even though it's a fairly infamous incident and the movie covers that time period. Barnes recently wrote about her experience for Gawker in response to the film's release. One thought I had while watching the film was that sometimes important messages are conveyed by very problematic people. That's something I realized in my own life because of my father. He was a criminal. He was in and out of prison my entire life. He sold drugs. He also cared for my grandmother and her health more ferociously than anyone else in the family ever did. And like NWA member Eazy-E, my father died of AIDS. So for me, that was a powerful part of the movie and a very important reminder about a disease that we just don't talk much about anymore. The numbers on AIDS and HIV are especially bad for Latino and Black communities in the United States. Rates of new HIV infections in Latinos are 3 times that of whites in the U.S., and among Blacks, 8 times that of whites. Corey Hawkins, who plays Dr. Dre, says that visibility is important.
It's about awareness, you know? And I think in our communities, we're so underserved, you know, we don't know, you know what I'm saying? It's just a lack of knowledge. It's a little bit of ignorance. And, you know, I think it starts in the home. I think it starts, you know, that conversation starts there. But you watch it happen, you know what I mean, over and over again. It plays out in all of our communities, you know, especially Latina and Black community. And it's sad, but I think this film really starts that dialogue. It really does get people talking, you know what I mean? Because when they saw Eazy pass away from this, people were confused.
Right.
They were like, wait, you know what I mean? But now, you know, it's sort of, I mean, like you said, the numbers haven't gone down. What is the problem? You know what I mean? And I think it has to do with people being afraid to just talk about it.
Talking to those guys was a lot of fun. They give very strong performances in the movie. They're young and just really starting their careers in earnest. It's got to be an exciting time for them. And Corey is right. People can be afraid to talk for so many reasons. Though sometimes it helps to be really honest about where you are in your life. Like when your career drops out from under you. When you're forced to grow and change against your will. That's what Spanish language newsman Salvador Morales faced in his life and work. He wanted to speak openly about his experience, and he brings us this essay. Here's Sal Morales.
In 2005, I faced a life-shattering event. I worked at a television station in Los Angeles. For 5 years, I considered it my home. I was a well-known weatherman and substitute news anchor. But then the station decided that it was time for us to part. Divorces are not easy. And being fired felt just like that, a one-sided divorce where I had no say-so. When you work in television, you're always a bit paranoid that something like this can happen to you. And like many people working in the industry, I too had gotten the pink slip before. But this time, it hurt. I loved living in Los Angeles. I loved my job. My co-workers were my friends. I was invited to their homes. I also had the respect of my bosses. Also, I had a cat. an Egyptian male named Clovis. He walked a little funny, the result of a shoulder injury from being bitten as a kitten by a coyote. This was my life, a job where I worked with friends and a cat who had me at the first purr. The day I was told I was no longer part of the family at the television station, I went home to Clovis and I sat on the floor of my darkened apartment. I woke up with him lying by my side. In a haze, I called my sister Maria, who lived in Miami. I told her that I didn't feel well. She got on a plane to California that day. When she arrived, she took me to the hospital. I was having chest pains. Once I got back home, I slept for 4 days. When I finally woke up, I looked around and I decided to say goodbye to Los Angeles and move back to Miami. By then, my mom had joined us in California. Together, she and my sister helped me pack. By this time, the holidays were upon us. I had never spent Christmas with my family in South Florida. As a single man who only lived to work, I usually spent the holidays on duty at the stations where I worked. In Miami, I started knocking on doors, attending conferences, and reconnecting with people in the business trying to get work. I kept hitting walls. I was told my career was over. But angels show up if you reach out to them. One night on a lark, I started Googling people who had left the business and had gotten up from defeat. I had to find a role model in my new reality, and I found her in Deborah Norville, the former Today Show anchor who was famously let go in the early 90s. That night, I wrote to her, introducing myself, telling her what I had gone through, and she wrote me back. Soon we became pen pals. She didn't know me, but she understood my predicament. She gave her time and support when I needed it most. Never give up, she said again and again. She eventually included my story in her book, Thank You, Power. Yes, that's me in chapter 7. I wrote the next chapters of my professional life in Miami. They are filled with hard, humbling anecdotes where my ego was bruised. I had to come to terms with the fact that at 39, I was no longer seen as the anchor. I had to take jobs that ranged from making copies to writing press releases. Eventually, I made it back on air at a local TV station. It was hurricane season, and my knowledge of the subject made me marketable again. I hosted a series of hurricane prevention segments. For this, I was nominated for an Emmy. It led to more work, another news program. I reported and produced segments. I even got my own public affairs show dealing with immigration. Other jobs followed. But then things changed again. In the ever-shrinking newsrooms of the 2010s, budgets kept getting slashed and pink slips rained like confetti. Some of them, as the song says, rained down on me. Everyone kept telling me to throw in the towel. Get out of such a volatile, cruel business. Journalism is dying. Go into teaching, they said. But I refused. Because every time I think I should get out, someone pulls me back in. Want to work on a story? Ask an editor from a national music magazine. How about working on this digital project? Ask another in D.C. Just this July, I attended a summer intensive journalism program in New York, where I was immersed in the ever-changing world of technology. Do not believe for a second that journalism is dead. It isn't, they told us. It has evolved, and if you're going to survive and thrive in it, you have to evolve too. Just like the talkies took over Hollywood 100 years ago, so has the internet revolutionized journalism. But it hasn't killed it, and it won't. I learned more new things in those 2 intensive weeks that I learned in the past 2 years, and I'm already putting them into practice as I keep jumping from project to project. Yes, I might never be the weatherman or the anchorman again, but I still have a lot to offer and a lot to learn, and I'm hungry for it all. Instead of concentrating on what was or wallowing in self-pity, I am becoming something new, open to the new possibilities, knowing that angels will keep knocking on my door to offer opportunities. They will ask me to share my expertise and allow me to do what I love to do the most, tell compelling stories. After all, wherever we share them now, in print, the internet, television, or radio, content will always be king, and my television screen will never fade into black.
Thank you, Sal, for sharing your story with us. You know, as Sal just described, many of us have had moments in life that are real turning points. For me, one fun thing about getting older has been being able to look back and identify those points easily. But in the moment, I mean, you're just way too close to see them. Every week, we end our show with a little sabiduría, or words of wisdom. This week, we turn to best-selling author Isabel Allende. She had a very different experience of reaching that moment as a journalist from her time as a young woman in Chile.
Well, I was a young journalist, a feminist journalist, and I did humor articles in a magazine called Paula. And Pablo Neruda, the great Chilean poet, was in his 70s and living in the coast in Isla Negra, in a little village in the coast. And he would read my articles, and then he called the publishing house and asked me to visit him. So I thought he wanted me to interview him, of course. I washed my car, I brought a new tape recorder, and I headed for Isla Negra. This was winter, it was raining. I got there, and he showed me his collections of bottles, of paintings, of books. And then we had lunch, a beautiful Chilean corvina and white wine. And then I said, okay, Don Pablo, I'm ready for the interview because I have to go back and it's raining and it's getting to be very dark. And he said, what interview? And I said, well, I came to interview you. He said, oh, no, my child, I would never be interviewed by you. You are the worst journalist in this country. You are always putting yourself in the middle of every story. You lie all the time. And I'm sure that if you don't have a story, you make it up. Why don't you switch to literature where all these defects are virtues? And I thought the guy had lost it and I didn't pay any attention. I was very humiliated. This happened in the winter of 1973. Two or three months later, we had the military coup in Chile. And then freedom of the press ended this very same day of the coup. And I remained in Chile for a year trying to work, but it was impossible because with censorship and self-censorship, no journalist can do any kind of work that is meaningful. And eventually, I was so scared of the repression that I left my country with my children and my husband of the time. And I went to Venezuela, where I could not work as a journalist. I did all kinds of odd jobs until in 1981, I started writing a book, something that eventually turned out to be The House of the Spirits, my first novel.
Can you imagine hearing that from someone of the likes of Pablo Neruda? Isabel Allende launched her career as a novelist with the book The House of the Spirits. She's since written 17 other novels and won dozens of literary prizes, so thanks, Pablo, for planting the seed and helping her come into her own. That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Happy birthday, Nancy Trujillo. I miss you. You make everything happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your guest host and Latino USA senior producer, Daisy Rosario. Always so honored to sit in for La Jefa, our host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Catch us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Unique New York. Unique New York. The lips, the teeth, the tip of the tongue. The lips, the teeth, the tip of the tongue.
Ooh.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant making and social investing. More at kresge.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.